everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Yeah, we got a good show today. I just can't wait to get into it. I'm feeling really good right now. You know, I always like to talk about the weather. And here in New York City, it's summertime, and it's been kind of hot and unpleasant. But today, we had a little rain in the morning. And for those of you out in drought lands, you know, I don't want to rub it in that we have some water here. But we did have a little rain. And what's especially lovely about the rain for me is I live next to a park. And the park, about 10 years ago, was a really nice place. But somehow it's changed over the last few years where we have a lot more screaming of all ages. And it doesn't sound as a happy place, but maybe it is. Maybe I'm just misinterpreting the noises. But when it rains, it's quiet. And I've really been enjoying a nice day today with a little peace and quiet. But now it's dried up a little bit, so maybe the screaming will start again real soon. Okay, I want to bring on my first guest. I'm so excited to talk about what we're going to be talking about. This is really incredible news that we all need to be discussing and sharing. Matthew Liebman is senior attorney in the litigation program at the Animal League Defense Fund. And he is involved in all aspects of the ALDF civil cases, including investigating reports of animal cruelty, conducting legal research, developing new legal theories, and appearing in court. He has litigated cases including ALDF versus Conyers, which resulted in the rescue of more than 100 dogs from a North Carolina hoarder, and another case in which 7 horses were saved from starvation, Animal Place versus Chung, which seeks justice for 50,000 hens abandoned without food by egg farmers. Matthew's writing has appeared in the Animal Law Review, the Journal of Animal Law, the Stanford Environmental Law Journal, and the Animal Legal and Historical Web Center with Bruce Wagman. Matthew co-authored A Worldview of Animal Law, which examines how the legal systems of different countries govern our interaction with animals. So much more about Matthew. You can read that at my site, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Meanwhile, welcome to It's All About Food, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. I know you've been really busy, especially with this recent ruling in Idaho, which I want to talk quite a bit about. So before we get started, I want to give you a big round of applause, you and your entire team, for
thank
doing
you very much. Yeah,
incredible
definitely a
work.
Team effort.
This is really important, and I hope you've taken the time to just, like, take it all in and celebrate for a moment.
We have, yes.
Oh, good. Because sometimes, you know, when we're involved in some things, it just gets so crazy that there is never really a moment to take it all in and enjoy what you've accomplished. And we need to do that for our own sanity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And animal law is definitely a challenging field, and to have big wins like this can seem rare,
okay.
But
so
happy when they happen.
Before we get to the big win of last week, I want to talk about these ag-gag laws and how our wonderful justice system possibly could have approved this type of legislation. Can you give me a little history?
Sure. So ag-gag laws are essentially make it a crime to conduct an undercover investigation at an agricultural facility, which is typically read to mean a factory farm or a slaughterhouse. And these are basically an industry-coordinated response to a recent trend over the last decade or so. There have been maybe 100 undercover investigations at factory farms and slaughterhouses, and every single one of them has revealed horrific animal suffering. And that can be anything from malicious and sadistic cruelty, like workers punching or kicking animals for no reason, but also things that are common and prevalent throughout the industry, like intensive confinement of hens in battery cages or of pregnant sows in tiny gestation crates. And obviously, when these investigations come out, they reveal things that the industry would much rather keep hidden from the public. And so their coordinated response has been to approach state legislators and have them introduce these ag-gag bills, which essentially, rather than going after, trying to find a way to stop the animal cruelty, to instead shut up the activists and put them in prison for trying to show the American public what really happens on these farms.
I guess I don't understand how those things get passed.
Yeah,
we're all about freedom of speech, and I don't know, we seem to have a romance with whistleblowers in this country. It's hard to believe, but it happens that these things get passed.
Yeah, there are 8 states that have passed ag gag laws, and these are, not surprisingly, mostly heavily agricultural states, ones with a very effective ag lobby that spends a lot of money lobbying politicians. And so I guess we shouldn't be too surprised when pro-industry bills get introduced.
Okay, so you went to Idaho and filed a complaint and won.
That's right. Yeah, last Monday we finally got a decision. This case was filed last year, essentially challenging their ag gag law under various provisions of the Constitution. We just got a decision on Monday, last Monday, ruling in our favor.
Now, I don't watch a lot of television, but occasionally I watch these programs that show different court proceedings with lawyers, and they're very dramatic, and things happen at the last minute, and people are running around trying to find information. Was this anything like what we see on television?
Last Monday wasn't. That was, I was just in my office and got word that the court had issued its opinion. So, the kind of drama we see on TV is obviously fictionalized and a bit more condensed than how it happens. But that's not to say this case hasn't been interesting to litigate. We've had certainly been in court in Boise on a couple of occasions arguing our case to the judge in fairly packed rooms with very interested reporters and members of other public interest groups and farmers, and even the legislators that introduced these bills were coming to the hearings to see how see what was going to happen to their law. So there were moments of excitement and interest, but last Monday was, we just got word that the judge had issued his opinion, and we're reading it on our computers like everybody else.
I read the opinion. It's pretty amazing. Did you have any idea during the proceedings that it was going to go this way?
We were optimistic. I think our intuitions were similar to yours, that there's just no way that a bill or a law that's prime intent was to silence half of a debate on a significant public issue could possibly pass constitutional muster. And there was an earlier stage in the litigation, what's called a motion to dismiss, where the state had tried to have our lawsuit dismissed on various procedural and legal grounds, and the ruling on the motion to dismiss strongly suggested that the judge was seeing things our way, but that was a preliminary motion, and so he didn't rule in our favor at that point, but we had suggestions that he saw this law is violating the Constitution in the same way we did. So we filed what's called a motion for summary judgment, which the judge granted, and that's the decision that you have.
Now, is this going to stick, or do you think, will there be any appealing? Can that be done at this level?
It can be done. We don't have any indication one way or another whether the state's going to appeal. I know that the ag lobby in Idaho is strong pushing the Attorney General to appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And if that happens, we're certainly ready and willing to go the distance. We think the judges on the Ninth Circuit will see things the way Judge Windmill did in this case and agree that this statute violates both the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution.
Well, anybody who's not familiar with any of this, if you just know that these facilities where they're raising animals are closed to anyone. Some of these are just like these giant warehouses with no windows in some cases. You can't see anything, and you wonder why that is. It's because nobody wants to see what's inside. Even the workers that are inside, not just the non-human animals, but the human animals are treated horribly as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that's why these ag gag laws have brought together a pretty wide-ranging coalition of public interest organizations. I mean, our lawsuit was not just the Animal Legal Defense Fund and other animal rights groups. You know, we had people for the ethical treatment of animals and farm sanctuary, but we also had groups like the ACLU of Idaho. We had environmental organizations like Western Watersheds Project and a lot of other groups from different communities. You know, journalists were outraged about this statute, and farm worker protection groups were outraged as well. As you say, you know, these are low-paid workers that are often treated horribly. And if one of them, you know, wants to pull out their cell phone and take video of the horrible working conditions they're subjected to, they shouldn't go to prison for doing so.
Exactly. Now, one of the things I loved in the declaration or in the ruling was a reference to the author Upton Sinclair and his book The Jungle, which came out in the early 20th century. And because of that fictional book, which was based on a lot of horrible things that were actually going on in meatpacking plants in Chicago, we got the Pure Food and Drug Act and Federal Meat Inspection Act. We got good legislation that improved our food system, and it pointed out that Upton Sinclair, had he been around today with ag gag laws, could have been criminalized.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was a good point that the judge made in his decision. And you know, one of the things that ag gag laws criminalize are gaining access to a facility by misrepresentation. And a lot of the ways undercover investigations take place is someone will go and apply for a job, but not disclose that they're affiliated with an animal rights organization or not disclose that they're a journalist. And they go and they do the job. They're not sort of slacking or depriving the owner of the farm of anything. They're not stealing, but they, in the course of doing their job, document things and ask questions, and that's how these investigations take place. And if you make it a crime to lie on an employment application, then you're essentially shutting down these investigations. And that's how Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle. You know, he went in as an employee without disclosing who he was or what his intentions were.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we all reap the benefits of his having done that through, you know, landmark federal legislation that has been crucial to food safety.
Okay, so I'm going to turn the subject around a little bit. This is kind of related. I don't know how familiar you are with it, but I'm just wondering how you feel about what's been going on with Planned Parenthood recently, because there were some undercover videos, and now they're turning against Planned Parenthood. And there was even a Los Angeles court that was banning future videos until further notice coming out from this particular group that was doing undercover work. Now, I'm on the left side in general in my politics, and I believe Planned Parenthood is doing good work. So I wasn't really happy when these videos came out, even though I know they've been edited and misconstrued, whatever. But do they have that right to do that under the Constitution with free speech?
I can't say. I don't know the facts well enough to say whether or not they had a right to do that. I mean, I will say that, you know, if we have a commitment to the values of the First Amendment, that should apply regardless of what the subject matter is. And so I'm also on the left, but, you know, I don't think judges should be prohibiting the release of information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Judge Windmill makes the point in this ag gag decision that the solution to speech you don't like is more speech. And I think Planned Parenthood has every right to come out and say, you know, these conversations are taken out of context. Here's, you know, what this conversation was really about. And, you know, in a democratic society, having that conversation is significant. And the cure for speech you don't like is more speech. And so, I would not support sort of preemptive bans on the release of information. I think the better solution is for people to have a conversation about what's wrong with those videos if they're misleadingly edited, or, you know, to try to give more context about what's been left out of the videos. And certainly, you know, the meat industry is welcome to do that if they want to look at these videos and say, you know, these practices are defensible for these reasons. They're welcome to do that, and we'll have an open public debate about it. But we can't have
that
debate.
And we'll let people come into our facilities and see for themselves, right?
Yeah.
That's what they should be doing. Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah. We know what we'd find, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you said there were 8 states, so I imagine you're going to be on the path attacking another state pretty soon, if not already.
Yeah, we already have a case going in Utah challenging their ag gag statute. So, you know, that case is moving forward. It's unclear what's going to happen in Idaho if there's an appeal. Obviously, we'll have to spend resources on that. So I don't know whether we're going to be, you know, going after another state in the near future. It's certainly a possibility, and those other 6 states that we haven't sued yet are definitely ones that we're scrutinizing and trying to figure out what our next best step is. But I would say that none of them are exempt from constitutional scrutiny.
And are you involved at all, or do you have an opinion on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? That's another goodie that's been out and about for a number of years.
Yeah, that's a you know, one of these statutes that was passed, essentially turning some forms of activism, even you know, some forms of what we think of as traditional protest activity, lumping them under the umbrella of terrorism, and I think that's extremely problematic. You know, these ag gag laws go much further than the AETA does, but you know, AETA is something that the Animal Legal Defense Fund opposed when it was a bill, and it's, you know, we were disappointed to see that the constitutional challenges to that statute so far haven't succeeded.
Yes, well, I mean, the idea of labeling someone a terrorist who's trying to fight the terrorism is a scary thing. I don't support any kind of violence, and I know that that's how that act came about or was strengthened, because of some violent acts that unfortunately shouldn't have happened. Nobody was hurt, but a lot of people got scared. And I like going the route that you're doing, fighting with the law and bringing sense and clarity until people get it. Now, what I want to know is, you're a smart guy. You've had a great education. How is it that you wanted to work in this field? Hello? Hey, everybody. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. We had a little brief interruption there and a little technological glitch. Maybe it's the rain. I'm not sure what it is, but we're back. And Matthew, you're back.
Yes, sorry about that.
Okay. Oh, no problem. I'm glad everything's okay. So what I wanted to know is how a nice guy like you ended up in a place like the Animal League Defense Fund, which is great. But, I mean, we need more great attorneys fighting the fight for the voiceless. And what inspired you to do that?
Well, my journey to animal rights started when I was a teenager. I had a pet bird who I was told should just feed him whatever I was eating in addition to his regular pellets and fruit and vegetables. And I was eating chicken one day and went to give him some and sort of had this weird realization that the chicken, that it seemed kind of cannibalistic. And then it sort of dawned on me that if this chicken was so close to him that he shouldn't eat it, that maybe I shouldn't eat it either, given the strong bond and friendship that we had. And that sort of opened my eyes to the, obvious reality that meat comes from animals. And I'm a vegetarian shortly after that. In college, I was a philosophy major, and in a first year philosophy class, read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and that helped crystallize things and started getting me thinking more philosophically about animal issues, and continued to do a lot of reading in animal ethics, and was weighing going to grad school in philosophy and getting a PhD and continuing to focus on animal ethics versus going to law school and getting a JD. And I thought that maybe I could do a little more good, practically speaking, or change more animals' lives if I went to law school rather than grad school. So I went to law school knowing that I wanted to do animal law, and made some connections with folks at the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And after I graduated, did a clerkship with a judge for a year and then came straight here and been here for almost 8 years.
Wow. Well, it's wonderful that you're there and that they have you and that you're able to do this great work. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm very lucky to be doing the work that I'm doing. It's gratifying and I think makes a difference.
There's a lot of work to be done, unfortunately.
That's true, for sure.
And I wish we had more attorneys that were interested in fighting the fight for the right and for the voiceless rather than making a lot of money.
Yeah. You know, people, there's lots of ways for people to support us. People who are already lawyers can sign up to be part of our pro bono work if they want to help contribute to some cases. And even people who aren't lawyers can sign up for our action alerts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter and come to our website and find out what people can do to help animals.
Now, it's been a week since this ag-gag law in Idaho has been declared unconstitutional. What's the response been since that time?
Overwhelmingly positive. In fact, I just got an email today from someone who teaches at the University of Idaho's agriculture program thanking us for bringing the lawsuit and congratulating us on our win. Almost everyone I talked to has been surprised that such a thing could pass and relieved that the courts were willing to strike it down.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I want to have faith in the justice system, and I want to believe that good will prevail, but so much has happened where it's just so frustrating. But, you know, occasionally something wonderful happens, and I want to think that we're slowly but surely moving in a very, very positive direction.
I think that's right. I mean, the legal system has usually lags behind a little bit. It's, I think, by nature a conservative institution, just because so much is based on precedent and what's happened before and what the law is rather than what it should be. But I think with there are cases where we can make progress, and I think this is one of them.
So do you have any long-term plans? Do you see yourself on the Supreme Court? Do you think we'll get some animal-friendly lawyers on the Supreme Court one day?
I'd like to think one day. I know that I would never make it through the confirmation process, so I don't have any judicial aspirations myself. But I've known some really, really amazing judges. I clerked before I came to ALDF, and the judge I clerked for who has sadly passed away, was, you know, when I was working for him, an 83-year-old white guy, but he got these issues. He was incredibly compassionate and progressive, and I think if had the right animal case come before him, you know, he would give it a fair shot and strive to do justice. And I think, you know, those judges are not especially common, but they're out there. I know of at least one vegan judge, and you know, this decision in Idaho shows that even judges in places that we might think of as conservative are willing to do the right thing and honor the Constitution when the case comes before them.
Okay, I have one more question. When you're working really hard on a case, what are you eating?
Well, I'm a vegan myself. You know, the first rule of legal ethics is don't eat your clients. So I'm generally a pretty healthy eater. So today it's brown rice and tempeh and chard.
Nice, excellent. I'm really glad to hear that, and that's probably what gives you a lot of energy and clarity. I just remember recently that during a lot of governmental meetings, I think it was when they were trying to figure out how to deal with this Iran nuclear policy stuff, somebody documented what everybody was eating, and it was a disaster, all kinds of candy and junk food. And I mean, you just can't do anything right when you're eating like that.
Yeah, I will say that they just, not far from our office, opened up a vegan fast food restaurant, Amy's Drive-Thru, and so I had a burger and fries and a vegan milkshake that were actually pretty good.
Nice. That sounds good. Well, it can't be. It's got to be a lot better than the animal variety.
Yes, that's
fair. Okay. Well, I don't hear my theme song. I hear the Mr. Softy theme song outside. but that's a good time to say thank you very much for joining me on It's All About Food. And keep up the great, great work.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, thanks, Matthew. All right, let's take a little break while the Mr. Softy truck is going around my neighborhood. I'm not promoting Mr. Softy. He's just always here. All right, we'll take a little break, and then we're going to be back with Robin Lamont. I'm really looking forward to speaking with her about her new book, The Trap. All right, everybody, we're back. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And remember, you can find out a lot more about me and my work at responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit. And I put up all kinds of lovely vegan recipes. I have a blog called What Vegans Eat. Have you been there recently? All I do is show you what I eat every day, because so many people have asked me, what do you eat? Now, you know, in pictures and text, and often linked to recipes. So I make it really easy if you want to try and make some of the dishes that I'm showing. Great. And that's responsibleeatingandliving.com. And you can also email me at info@realmeals.org. My next guest, I've had her on the program before, and it's Robin. She's Robin Lamont, Broadway actress, private investigator, and assistant DA, and a novelist. And we're going to be talking about her most recent book, The Trap. Robin, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I just finished reading your book. It was great.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's great to be talking with you.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I was just talking about with Matthew Liebman about this recent Idaho ag gag law, which was declared unconstitutional, is...
Yes. Awesome.
It is awesome. We can't say it enough. There was a actual section in the judge's ruling that cited Upton Sinclair and his book, The Jungle, which came out in the early 20th century, a fictional story about the horrors going on in Chicago slaughterhouses. And I thought, that's why your books are so important.
Well, you know, I'm a big, big believer in stories and the power of stories. I think they have an emotional power that engages people. And then kind of when you step in a character's shoes, you're brought on a journey. And that's what Upton Sinclair did. He brought people into the world of a slaughterhouse through a fiction story. And, I mean, the book had enormous impact. So, yeah, he's a hero.
He is a hero. His book, however, was, there was no happy ending in his book. It was depressing from start to finish. And it was, I was nauseous in my stomach reading it the entire time. But it did make tremendous change, and that is good.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when it comes to animals, unfortunately right now, there are very few happy endings. You know, the overturn of the, well, almost overturn of the Idaho ag-gag law is a happy ending, but what I'm trying to do in my series is embed the facts of what is really happening for animals in a fictional story, and it's pretty difficult if you're relying on the truth to have a happy, giggly ending. You can maybe have a satisfying ending to each book, but the struggle continues.
Yeah, I like the way you sprinkled different statements that were reflecting current policy and current truth throughout this story.
Go ahead.
And it does have, fortunately, a happy ending. I don't want to give that away, but to some degree it does, and it's just nice. So people can learn about a lot of horrors and in a very thrilling and in fun way. Fun, it's not a good word, but I did enjoy reading it. Because it's a good story.
Thank you, and that's the whole point. I mean, I want people to enjoy the story. That's
all right.
Really
now,
important.
The story is about. Well, why don't you give me a brief summary? It's about our wildlife agency policies and hunting. Hunting is a very hot topic right now, and I think we'll dig a little bit more into that right now, and what people say. The reasons people give for needing hunting or not needing hunting, and then what really goes on, because apparently, according to your story, there's a lot that goes on that is not necessarily legal, not necessarily beneficial, and people don't know about it.
That's true. That's really true. Well, in The Trap, the Kinship Series main investigator, Jude Brannick, is sent into Idaho, of all places, where a government agent with the Wildlife Services has been found caught and dead in his own trap. So that's how it begins. And in her search to help find the real killer, she encounters Wildlife Services, which is a true existing agency with the U.S. government, who it's a part of the USDA, and their mission, stated mission, is to help humans and wildlife coexist. But when you look deeper and read some of the exposés and read a little bit more about the agency, they're really far from that. It's a very opaque agency paid for by tax dollars, and they're engaged in some really nefarious activities when it comes to killing animals.
Now, a number of things that go on is that we have ranchers that are growing animals to feed people, like cattle, and sometimes sheep. and they don't want their animals attacked by wild animals. So they use these rules, or the excuse of these rules, to shoot some of these animals in the wild, wolves and coyotes.
Mm.
And it's all to promote the growing of animals to feed people, which is something I don't think is a good thing to begin with for lots of reasons.
Yep.
But
well,
But
for me, you know, I mean, animal agriculture is one of the most powerful economic driving forces in our country, and we do, or throughout the world. And we do an enormous amount, I mean, to hide what is really going on. I mean, Matthew Lieberman was talking earlier about the ag gag laws. Well, you know, I, as a suspense writer, I think these huge corporate and government structures at the root of animal exploitation are great foils in a thriller and suspense novel, so I tend to go after them.
Absolutely. You know, it's just like the Republican candidates right now are great material for comedians. you have great material for thrillers, but it's scary because it's real. So I wondered throughout the book how much was based on real occurrences and what you actually made up. So maybe you could tell us of something that was true that you based some of it on.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I would pretty much say that all of what happens to animals in the trap is true or has been documented somewhere. I relied an awful lot on an expose by Sacramento Bee journalist Tom Knudsen, who wrote a series of pieces, and they read like a thriller. He interviewed ex-Wildlife Services agents who told him what was really going on behind the scenes. One such thing is that Wildlife Services kills about 4 million animals a year. And that's what's reported. Now, they engage in a lot of very brutal trapping and hunting methods that are not allowable in the individual states by regulation. For instance, even in Idaho, aerial gunning is not permitted by state regulation. Poisoning coyotes, wolves, bears, that's not allowable under state regulations. But because the Wildlife Services is a federal agency, they're exempt from all of those rules.
Hmm.
I do deal in the book with a practice that I found just awful, which is in the trapping. You know, when these agents set traps, they may set a trap for a coyote or a wolf. But animals don't read the sign on the trap. They don't. They're simply drawn to the bait.
Mm-hmm.
So an enormous number of unwanted, untargeted animals get caught in these traps, including domestic pets. And there are quite a number of instances where families lost pets who were trapped in a leg hold trap, or they were poisoned by these M44 cyanide capsules. And the owner had to watch their dog die, writhing on the ground in agony from these cyanide capsules. So it's pretty brutal stuff, but it does go on.
It's brutal to companion animals that people love. It's brutal to wild animals that people don't know but deserve to live and deserve to live without horrific cruelty and just a horrible, horrible death.
I agree.
Yeah. So your book exposes a lot of this, and I'm just constantly, I'm speechless because I don't understand why humans want to do this and create so much violence, and we have such a capacity to create tools that will do so much violence. The traps we create just become worse and worse and more painful. And not only are these animals unnecessarily killed, but they are tortured in horrific ways.
They do suffer. And, you know, I'm trying in these novels to create a sense for, you know, my main characters, the investigator here, Jude Brannick. She's at a loss, like you are, to understand why and how this is possible. I think at one point in the book, she is brought out into the wilderness to see this incredible, endless acreage of miles and miles of Idaho mountains and forests and streams. And she says, where do the animals get to live? If they don't get to live free of suffering here, where do they get to live? And she's at a loss herself.
Now, some will tell us that hunting is necessary. In fact, I just saw an article in the New York Times yesterday about hunting in Africa, saying that because of what happened to Cecil the Lion and the outcry that happened because of the trophy hunting, they're saying that conservation efforts could actually do damage in this area. We hear a lot of people talking about how hunting is actually necessary in order to control wildlife. But I think you even mention in the book the importance of wolves and how the area was actually degraded because of the lack of wolves.
Yeah, for sure. Until the mid, I guess, 1990s, the gray wolf was pretty much extinct from the northern Rockies, and that's their natural, a good habitat for them. And until they were reintroduced and put on the endangered species list, which they now have been removed from in the northern Rockies, they weren't there. And a lot of the biologists in Yellowstone found with the reintroduction of the wolf that the entire landscape began to come back. Birds and fish and small mammals that were being eaten by the prey of the wolf were now coming back, and it was a richer landscape than without wolves. So I honestly believe that, you know, there are ways to coexist without trapping and hunting these animals.
I believe it too. And you also mentioned, and I believe this is true of all non-human animals, that they don't kill for sport.
Yes.
Like humans do.
Well, we do an awful lot to animals for sport, don't we?
Yeah.
No, animals don't kill for sport. They kill for survival. And there's quite a bit of evidence that shows that when we as humans go in and disrupt the packs of these predators, whether it's wolves or coyotes, we actually do more damage to our own self-interest. That wolves, they operate in a pack, and once the pack is disrupted by the killing of one or two, the juvenile wolves, without a family, are actually much more likely to go after livestock when the pack can't teach them to hunt the deer and the elk that is their natural prey.
Hmm. Oh, my.
Oh, my. I think, you know, the other thing is that one of the biggest problems for our country's wildlife is we're taking their habitat.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking it. And for them to go outside what we consider are appropriate boundaries for wolves or coyotes, it's because we're encroaching on their land.
Now, a lot of people would say that population, human population, is the problem, and I won't disagree. There certainly are a lot of people on the planet, but we could be doing a much better job, and we could be living a lot more efficiently, and I think living happier and healthier as a result if we weren't using so much land to grow plants to feed animals that ultimately feed people.
Well, I'm with you there. And, you know, one of the reasons that Wildlife Services is so active out west is because they're working basically as an extermination service on behalf of the ranchers. Ranchers who are grazing their herds on public land.
Oh, thank you for bringing this up. I wanted to bring this up next, and here you go. Let's talk about those public lands.
Yeah. Well, we all knew or had heard this study from, what was it, Cleavon Bundy, who refused to pay his grazing fees to the Bureau of Land Management and basically got away with it by standing there with his guns and his posse and driving off the agents for land management. But most of the ranchers out west raising sheep and cattle primarily are using public lands to graze their cattle. And they pay a fraction of what it would cost if they owned the land themselves.
You rarely hear about this, and most people don't know about it, and it's infuriating. I've heard the term welfare ranching because these are public lands. They belong to all of us citizens of the United States, and they are being rented for literally next to nothing, pennies, graze animals. And then the land pretty much is seriously degraded after these animals come through, and the ranchers don't have to do anything to improve it. And it's called welfare ranching. There are people that are always annoyed that some of us on the left primarily want to help people that are poor, people that don't have opportunity, and welfare payments, variety of different ways, help support them for food, for education, for health care, etc. And yet we don't talk about this other form of welfare, really, which is using citizens' land that we're renting for next to nothing for these people to use and abuse.
Absolutely. It's ruining the environment, and it goes even beyond that. It's basically government subsidies for the ranchers. They get the use of government, private, public land if and when a wolf or predator takes one of the livestock. They're generally reimbursed for the loss of that livestock. So they get paid back. It's not about them losing that much money. And now you have Wildlife Services, that's a federal agency that's basically doing all of their extermination of predators for them on public land. So it's all the same story to me. It's all about, you know, the subsidy of meat, of cheap meat, because if the ranchers had to use their own land, they had to take care of the wolf problem on their own, hopefully with humane methods, then beef would be, you know, extraordinarily expensive. But our government subsidizes it because one of the USDA's missions is to promote agriculture along with animal agriculture. So,
You mention in your book at this one particular hearing in the story where people were talking about hunting that there are more humane ways to keep wild animals away from ranchers' animals, but they're too expensive.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There was a study done in California, a project set up with the humane methods, deterrent methods, basically. They include guards, dogs, you need human herders, special lighting, something called fladry, which is tiny little flags set along a fence will actually keep wolves and coyotes away. But these methods are expensive. If you're going to pay a herder to circle your sheep at night, it's going to be much more expensive. And that's why ranchers don't generally do it. But in this one particular area in California, they stuck with the humanely deterrent methods, and out of, I think, 27,000 sheep, only four were lost in 2012. So it's a tiny, tiny percentage, and it's possible.
Now, the other part that feeds into all of this is fear.
Ah.
And people are afraid, and in some cases, their fear is not justified.
Yeah, I really tried in the book to, because my investigator was going into the heart of hunting and trapping land and the culture, the mindset of coyote derbies and wolf derbies where they like to kill them. I really tried to dig into that mindset and try to figure out what was going on. And there's quite out west, there's a real demonization of wolves. It's really gone back for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal belief is that demonizing the wolf makes him that much more of a great target. I mean, to kill. You look at Cecil the lion. Why does somebody want to go and kill a lion?
Yep.
Because it makes him feel like a warrior. It makes him feel like a man. I don't know. It's exciting. The bigger, more ferocious the animal, the bigger the challenge, and the more the ego gets from the killing of the animal. That's my personal belief, but I think wolves fit that bill.
Have you heard the recent story about a hiker in Yellowstone National Park that was attacked by a grizzly bear?
I did vaguely hear about it. I don't know the circumstances or the facts, but I was sort of led to believe that perhaps this hiker didn't use reasonable precautions. And it was a mama bear protecting her cubs.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring it up in the earlier segment because I was thinking this family of bears really needs a good lawyer.
Indeed.
And maybe. It's funny, but it's also sad because these non-human animals are being accused, at least it's believed that this one bear attacked this hiker, and now they're holding a family of bears and checking the DNA that they found to see if indeed this one bear killed this hiker. And I'm thinking, this bear, you can't question the bear. You can't ask, you know, what her motive was. She has no defense. She has no one defending her. And I'm sure that this hiker was partially to blame, as you think. But we have this fear of big animals. And unfortunately, the bear will likely be put down.
Yeah, it's not an even playing field, is it?
No, it's not. So, you've written The Trap, and I recommend it. Anyone who likes a good thriller, and especially if you know people that aren't really conscious or aware of what goes on with animals in this country, you might give them this fun book to read, as along with your other book, The Chain, which was another exciting read and talked about animals in factory farms. And what's next, Robin?
Well, this is a series, so I'm embarking on book three, which will deal with animal testing.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Now, you worked as a private investigator. Did you ever work in any of these arenas?
Not in any of these arenas, no. But I did work undercover for a number of years. So I tried to bring that into the trap in terms of what it's like to be an undercover investigator and have to maintain your cover when there's really nobody around to protect you, and how tenuous it feels. And yeah, it's dangerous.
It is dangerous. Well, I'm kind of looking forward to the next book. I'm sure it's going to be pretty bleak because I know that we do a lot of horrible tests on non-human animals, and some would say they're necessary, but if you really look into, I think the majority of testing that's done, it's not necessary. It might be debatable that some of it is necessary. I'm not quite sure, but it's not something that I support. And it's just another thing that we do as humans that I'm not particularly proud of.
I will try to give you, if not a happy ending, a satisfying one. They are possible. Look at the ag-gag law in Idaho. So, happy endings are possible.
Happy endings are very possible. Thank you, Robin, for your latest book and for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It is, and I know we keep talking about it, but we are going to get together and share a meal one day soon.
Absolutely.
Okay, that'll be fun. All right, take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to me. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this has been It's All About Food. My last guest was Robin Lamont, the author of the new book, The Trap, part of the Kinship series. And you can find out more about both my guests today at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, where you'll be able to listen to the archives of these shows and very soon transcripts, because we do transcribe our shows. Thanks for joining me, and remember, have a delicious week.